Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications.
Hello and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard. This week we're marking a changing of the guard at one of our major publications. If you're a reader of Country Guide, you'll know Leanne Minogue as the author of the Hanson Acres series. But if you're a reader of Grain News, you'll know her as the magazine's editor-in-chief since 2011. You're still going to see her work in Country Guide, but she's got a lot of other irons in the fire, and she's handing off the reins of Grain News to write a new chapter. I'd try and see how many more tortured metaphors I could get into that last sentence, but she's here on the line now. Leanne, hi, and welcome to Between the Rows.
Hi, Dave. Nice to talk to you.
Hello. Nice to talk to you, too. When you first started, I was scratching away in my own little corner of the Glacier Farm Media office. I wasn't nearly as involved with Grain News as I used to be. So one day I look up and, we've got a new editor and she's got a lot of firsthand experience both in farming and in the broader ag field. Now, with everything you were doing at the time, how did you come to work for us?
Getting this job wasn't any part of any organized plan on my part. Our farm is a half an hour from Weyburn, so when our son was born back in 2006, I wasn't real eager to commute to a job in town. Mm-hmm. And then one afternoon, Gord Gilmore, he's the editor of the Manitoba Cooperator now, Gord called me up and asked if I'd be interested in doing some freelancing. The ag community is a really small world, and it turned out I'd taken university classes in Saskatoon from Gord's father-in-law, Richard Gray. When Gord was looking for a freelancer, his ex-wife thought of me. So working a few hours a week as a freelancer was just great when my son was little. I wrote a few freelance articles for Grain News, and when I found out the last editor, Lindsay Smith, was going to take a six-month maternity leave, I called up the publisher and said I'd like to fill the spot. I remember telling him that even though I didn't have any editing experience at the time, surely I couldn't do too much damage in just 6 months. But she didn't come back from that leave, and I stayed on, and I always wondered, for the first few years, I sort of wondered that maybe no one in the Winnipeg office noticed I was still there.
Well, in my own case, it was kind of bizarre. I remember to come work for this sort of this odd duck of a publication. It used to be split up in sections. I remember at our dining room table, the second it came into the house, you know, it was sort of the only place I would ever see Gary Larson's, you know, The Far Side cartoons when I was a kid. You know, what was as a farmer, what was your experience of Grain News?
Exactly the same as you. I remember reading those cartoons, and it was the only farm publication that I read as a kid because it had all those great cartoons. Mm-hmm. That's why it's been such a great privilege to work at Grain News. Every farmer knows about it. Even those farmers that don't subscribe now, everyone knows about this publication, and it's just been a great feeling to tell people what I do.
Mm-hmm. And it's since then, it's been a weird decade for prairie grain farmers since he came on board, and it seems like there's both a greater supply and a greater demand for information also at the same time. You know, I don't like to make big sweeping generalizations about our readers, so if we were to focus on a specific prairie farming couple, what kinds of information do you think that Jeff and Elaine Hanson are looking for that a farming magazine like Grain News is providing today?
You're right, there's so many publications out there. Mm-hmm. Grain News has its own little niche at being the publication that has practical production advice. So it's not the place where we're covering policy debates. It's not the place where we're covering up-to-the-minute news on what's happening in the markets today. But if you want to know what pests might be showing up in your field this year, Grain News is for you. If you want to know what diseases to scout for, you're going to find that sort of thing in Grain News.
So in view of all the glory and glamour of editing a prairie farm publication, what's taking you away from us? Is it something I said?
It's not my coworkers. It's what I told you already, that I took this job to fill a six-month leave. Mm-hmm. And this winter, I looked at the calendar and I realized, hey, I've been here for 8 years. And I just think it's time for me to move on to whatever the next thing is. I'm not sure what it is yet. I'll keep writing for Country Guide, as you said. Mm-hmm. And I'll be more help on the farm, I hope. And I might end up doing some freelance writing for Glacier. I'm still not thrilled about the idea of commuting to town every day, but you never know what work-from-home opportunities might come up next.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's what's sort of in the future for Leanne Minogue, and we'll be seeing your name in other farm publications hopefully to come. Is there anything else that you'd like prairie farmers to hear that you haven't had a chance to tell them in print?
Well, just that I'm really going to miss this job. I realized this morning my husband got the grain truck stuck out in the slough in the back of the yard, and I went out to help him, and I made sure to take my phone with me so I could take photos and put them in the editor's column of Grain News because that's what I do. And then I suddenly realized I'm not going to have a column to put that in anymore. So I'm going to miss this gig.
And you're certainly going to put those photos on Twitter, I hope.
Well, I'll put them somewhere. Yeah, I can't just let them get off with getting the truck stuck on the slough.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll be looking forward to those pictures, and I'll be looking forward definitely to the next chapter in the Leanne Minogue story. Thanks very much for coming on Between the Rows, Leanne, and thanks very much for all your work as editor of Grain News over the last 8 years. It's been really awesome working with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on your show, Dave, and I've really enjoyed working with you, too.
Feelings mutual. Leanne Minogue is a farmer, farm writer, playwright in southeastern Saskatchewan, and the outgoing editor of Grain News. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard. Now, with Leanne's departure, we have a new editor-in-chief joining us at Grain News. If you're a consumer of Prairie Farm Media, you're probably more familiar with the work of Carrie Bélanger than you even realize. And she's here in the studio with us now. Carrie, hi, and welcome to Between the Rows.
Hi there, and thank you so much for having me. I am absolutely thrilled to be here.
And welcome to Glacier Farm Media also.
It might
seem to people listening in that I'm going to be asking a lot of the same questions that I literally just asked Leanne, because that's pretty much what I'm going to do. How has your career path led you to work for us?
Do you want the long version or the short version?
We'll take the medium version, please.
Okay, that would be great. Let's see here. I grew up in a small town in northwestern Ontario in the 70s and the 80s, which meant we had a ton of freedom. So I spent most of my time outdoors in nature. That sort of led me into the sciences. And so when I went to university, that's sort of what I concentrated on. After my first year of university, though, I took a bit of a break and I went to the United Kingdom for a year. And that's where I got my first taste of publishing. I was a temp at a publishing company. It published scientific materials. And I thought that the editor looked like she had the sweetest job in the whole place. So I was just a receptionist. It was like 1989, 1990. And I went up to her and I said, geez, how did you get this job? Looks like you have the best job in the world. And she said, well, I have a Bachelor of Science. I have a Bachelor of Arts in English. And, you know, I just kind of fell into this. And I thought, oh, gosh, that sounds amazing. And then I came back to Canada and went back to school. So as I was doing my science degree, though, I was also in love with writing and with English literature, sorry. And so I did both. And pretty shortly after graduating, you know, with both my science side and my writing side, I went right into editing and writing. And that sort of started my career. Mm-hmm. And so just over 10 years ago, I started at a company who did almost all agricultural publications. Mm-hmm. And everything just kind of clicked. It had the science component, it had the writing component, and I was hooked on agriculture right then and there.
So a lot of farmers who would have they would have seen your name in other publications. It's okay. You can mention them. You can mention them by name here.
One of the ones that a lot of farmers will know is I have been the editor of Alberta Seed Guide for a few years, as well as I've been the editor of Germination and Seed World magazine. Those of you who do sunflowers, I've also headed up the New Seed production guide that they put out now, plus a bunch of other agricultural publications. So yeah, I've been around for 10 years writing exclusively ag, but you know, Grain News has always been there. Mm-hmm. From my first entry into writing agriculture, I have been involved with Grain News. I have been writing for Grain News on and off for about 10 years. Mm-hmm. It was always my go-to publication. Like as soon as I was researching a new topic, or if I didn't understand something about production agriculture, that's where I would go. And I loved the stories that they would publish in Grain News. So it really was the place that I headed whenever I was looking at anything. So I worked with Lindsay before Leanne, and then I've worked with Leanne the whole time she has been the editor. Mm-hmm. So I feel quite honored to be the Grain News editor. I still feel like, pinch me, how did this happen? So it's just a fantastic place for me to be right now.
And it's like I was just saying to Leanne too. It's kind of this odd duck of a Prairie Farm publication too. When I was growing up on the farm, and even when I came to work for it back in the 90s, you know, it's a whole lot more, you know, streamlined now, both in its focus and even in the physical paper. But now the job of farming, I mean, is still relatively straightforward, but a lot about it seems to have changed, especially, you know, here on the prairies. You know, there's like tons of information, it seems, for everyone, but there's a lot that farmers still want to know or need to know.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I find that this industry is constantly changing, and that's going to be no surprise to farmers. The tools are constantly changing, crop production issues are constantly changing, and we want to keep farmers on top of that. This year, you know, we're really going to focus on production tips and know-how for farmers. We want to help increase farmers' yields. I want to help them cut their costs, reduce their labor, increase their efficiencies, and grow their profits. So as I think of future topics for future issues, all of those topics will be run through this filter. How will it be of value to farmers? Mm-hmm. So I think there's always something to write about and always something of value to someone else.
And of course, you've joined us right smack in the middle of what for a lot of us in farm media is the busy season, as farmers are making decisions ahead of spring seeding and in some cases this year, spring harvest. And so what can you tell us about what's coming up in the next issue of Grain News?
Excellent. Well, the March 24th issue has lots of practical information. Hmm. For instance, how to maximize your oat yields and improve oat quality, what millers are looking for, how to stage oil seeds, pulses, and soybeans the most effectively, and things to watch out for when you're doing that. We've also got a new look at the air carts by Case and John Deere, and tons of relevant and timely information from our columnists. But you know what? I would also like to mention, though, the April 7th issue, because we've got a ton of info going on weed management into this issue, managing resistance, what to do about weeds if you're in a time crunch, which might happen this spring for a lot of farmers, your top weed concerns and new weed threats. Also, a topic that's sort of emerging, or it's not a new topic, but it's one that farmers are really paying attention to, and that is stories on soil compaction. You know, how to manage it, how to mitigate it on the farm. For instance, what do you do about the ruts this year? And also how to set up controlled traffic farming. Oh, and one fun topic, tires versus tracks. So, you know, and we'll also have lots of stories on sprayers and nozzles as well. So I'm pretty excited about both the issues coming out soon.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've got you set up, I'm assuming, with a phone and email by now. So what's the best way for farmers to reach you if they've got story ideas or questions for the editor of Grain News?
You know what? Any way that is best for them. They can phone me. My phone number will be listed on the website and in the paper. Mm-hmm. Also, they can reach me through email if that's best for them, or even through Twitter, and I will be looking at these things.
Mm-hmm. So don't hesitate to give Carrie a call. Carrie Belanger is the editor-in-chief of Grain News. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard. Back in 2013, the burger and root beer chain A&W set off on a new course of ingredient sourcing, starting with what it called the Better Beef Campaign, which provoked a rather visceral reaction among some in Canada's farming and ranching community, as the chain had to look beyond just Canada for beef that met its new requirements, while some critics were concerned for what effect the campaign might have on consumer perceptions of Canadian beef in general. From a commercial standpoint, though, one can't deny that the campaign has succeeded. Since 2013, the company's been racking up year after year of same-store sales growth, and the chain has grown to almost 1,000 stores across the country. In the past few years, though, the company has also had its eye on a whole different benchmark for beef production. Susan Senecal is the CEO of A&W Food Services of Canada, and she joins us now. Susan, hi, and welcome to Between the Rows.
Thank you. Thanks, Dave. Nice to be here.
Thank you. And now the company is just starting to put the word out about its plan. So rather than have me be the spoiler here, let's just start with the company's announcement right off the hop.
Great. Well, we're excited to make a commitment to exclusively source and serve 100% Canadian grass-fed, grass-finished beef in all of our restaurants across Canada. And we're particularly excited as a Canadian company. Of course, we always look to Canada first when it comes to sourcing, and so this is an exciting new development in an emerging market that we think is very, very well suited to Canada's grasslands, and we're thrilled to be part of that movement.
Sounds exciting. Now, what's the timeline for all of this to happen?
Well, we've already started. In fact, I mean, as you probably know, and I'm sure many of your listeners know, all of this is a bit of a journey. So we started a few years back in terms of trying to understand what the grass-fed beef market was like. We could see it as an emerging consumer interest, and we wanted to understand it better. And certainly we wanted to understand how that fit in with Canadian beef much better. And so we've been working, talking to producers, thinking about things ourselves, for the past couple of years, and now we're ready to make the commitment, but also we're excited that we have so many partners that have already signed on. So we've seen a lot of enthusiasm by, you know, some of Canada's biggest beef suppliers, but, you know, just as exciting is a lot of smaller producers who, for them, we can become an easier path to market and really, you know, validate the things that they've been doing for many years.
Mm-hmm. And as you said, obviously, this didn't all just come about overnight, getting Cargill and JBS Canada, among others, involved. Now, you were also at the company was also recently present at Agribition, I believe. They were just discussing this not that long ago. Is that correct?
That's right. Yes. I mean, I think what we try to do is get out and talk face to face. We're sort of a face to face kind of company, and we do enjoy the opportunity to build relationships, hear from others, you know, what their obstacles are, what their excitement is, where their enthusiasm lies. And the Agribition we've been participating in, again, for a number of years. And that is an opportunity to meet many ranchers and other, you know, sort of leading voices in agriculture that have been great to inspire and to guide us as we've worked our way through this decision.
Mm-hmm. And now the chain's current beef suppliers that you've been working with for the last several years, I'm assuming that they've also been informed of this decision and that some of them are in fact taking part as well.
Yes, that's exactly right. We've been able to, you know, have the partnerships with some of our existing suppliers, which is exciting because that gives us a nice and easier transition. And in fact, I think they've also expressed their interest and enthusiasm in heading in this direction because, of course, you know, all of this is about celebrating Canadian beef. And while A&W can provide a ready market, and certainly I think, you know, you talked about the reputation of Canadian beef. I think Canadian beef has a stellar reputation across the world and in Canada. And this is just another way to have great conversations about beef and flavor of beef and, you know, the recipes that attract our guests to A&W. And I think that will make the partnership very, very interesting for all of the people involved.
Mm-hmm. And this doesn't, now the other thing too is that this doesn't represent the company stepping off of its previous commitments as far as its sourcing requirements for beef, does it?
No, that's right. Yes, that we in addition to beef raised without the use of hormones and steroids, we are certainly grass-fed will be a part of that. That'll be a part of our specification as well. And, you know, I think they go hand in hand. You know, what's got us, I think, on this particular time and this particular journey really is also the link with regenerative agriculture. And I think from the agricultural standpoint, you know, Canada enjoys such a bounty of, you know, land, and the agriculture industry here is world leading. But at the same time, you know, things like the soil, the grasslands, there's been a lot of conversation, a lot of movements towards how do you use, you know, what nature already has given us to regenerate, not just sustain. And that's been, I think, the particularly, you know, exciting part for me is really to see how much regenerative practices can improve the soil. And we all know that's where it starts. And, you know, grazing, well-managed grazing is a really important part of that cycle as well. So we think that we can fit in really well with the whole regenerative agriculture movement. And that's another piece that's really attracted a lot of attention, a lot of questions. And I think we're uniquely positioned to be able to support that movement with, you know, with making the path to market easier, but also by providing a very steady source of income for ranchers who are following these practices.
Mm-hmm.
They know we're buying 365 days a year.
Mm-hmm. And now, I believe this was mentioned when the company first made this announcement too, that A&W is going to be sort of taking kind of a visible role in the regenerative ag movement. Is that correct?
That's right. I think one of the things we tried to do is say, you know, what is it that we can do uniquely well? You know, ranchers can uniquely well raise cattle. Other, you know, great agricultural communities can do their things really, really well. What we can do is, I think, really understand what consumers are looking for, and we can support with by investing. So we've always invested in our beef, and, you know, we pay a premium for the grass-fed beef that we're buying. We've always paid a premium, and we think that that's an important financial incentive as well for people to join on and to, this is in some cases more expensive to raise. It costs more to raise, and therefore we want to make sure that there's lots of incentives to convert to the program where applicable, and to fairly compensate ranchers who are already using these practices. And we think that that will help with the expansion, just accelerate the expansion of what's already a great movement. And the whole soil health area and awareness is gaining momentum even among consumers. So certainly people in the agricultural community have known about this and focused on this for a long time, but I think what's important as well is that you have the whole consumer community who's increasingly interested in how things like soil health and the environment are being supported through the practices of agriculture. And I think this is a great opportunity to showcase the stewardship of agricultural community, and at the same time add to our great tasting burger recipes.
Mm-hmm. Now, that certainly speaks as to why the company is moving in this specific direction with respect to beef sourcing. I'm also wondering why now? Why now in March 2020 is the company announced or declared its intention to move in this direction?
Well, a few things are going on. One is that, this is a movement that's been gaining momentum. And, we really wanted to make sure that as we launched, that we had really clear visibility to Canadian supply. So we know that, we're a Canadian company. We think it's very important to support Canada. And so as that gained momentum within Canada, we felt more and more confident that we could have the kind of partnerships and the kind of programs that would attract a lot of attention. And that's happened, I think, touch wood, even better and more quickly than we might have imagined. So as we started to talk about it and, share with some producers, they've been, coming to the party. We've got some of Canada's biggest suppliers, as I said, but, we've got even smaller producers, and we expect to get even more by the time that even we finish this interview. We've really received a lot of attention, a lot of interest. Mm-hmm. And so the time just felt really right to be part of this movement and make it more visible to Canadians, make it more talked about, and help it to grow.
Now, obviously, there's been some assessment, some market projections going forward. Is there going to be really sufficient Canadian, all grass-fed, all grass-finished beef available to make this happen in a growing restaurant chain across Canada?
We believe so. We're very confident about that. That was part of, you asked about the timing. And as we thought about the timing, one of the things we wanted to be sure of was that we would be able to be part of supporting Canadian grass-fed beef. And again, as I say, we know that we already buy millions of pounds of Canadian beef every year, but this program already has allowed us to secure commitments for millions more pounds right as we speak. And with that kind of acceleration and that kind of growth, we can see clearly that there could be a time in the not so far future where we could be 100% grass-fed Canadian. So we're very confident and very excited about the rate of pickup and the kinds of questions we're getting, the kinds of partnerships that we're forming, and the kinds of producers who are calling us or talking to us when we're in person. It's been very, very validating.
Mm-hmm. And lastly, I'm wondering also about the taste of grass-fed beef. I've never personally done a side-by-side comparison between grass-fed and not, as far as burgers are concerned, and I'm a huge fan of burgers generally. Is the flavor for Canadian grass-fed beef going to be noticeably different than what customers of the chain now experience?
Well, we're a beef burger company, first and foremost, and we've always been committed to great-tasting burgers, so that's one of our first characteristics. But we think that The beef, as we've been tasting it and understanding it, is going to be a perfect complement to our recipes. Canadian beef has great qualities to it already, and having 100% grass-finished beef, I think, will just be a next step in terms of really being able to communicate the quality and taste of our beef to our guests. And we think that already our guests would say that we have the best tasting burgers in Canada. We certainly want to see the number of people who are experiencing that continue to grow.
Mm-hmm. And it'll be interesting to see the response. Please do keep us posted of new developments as they come up. Susan Senecal, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Susan Senecal is CEO for A&W Food Services of Canada. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard. So as if volatility wasn't enough of an issue in commodities and equities recently, it was followed late last week by a new price war between Saudi Arabia and Russia, which knocked crude oil futures down by 25% on Monday alone. That marked the biggest single-day drop in crude futures since the start of the Gulf War. And kids, we're talking about the 1991 Gulf War now. On top of that, the Dow Jones slid by as much as 2,000 points. So it's in that rosy context that Gord Gilmore spoke on Monday with J.P. Gervais, the chief agricultural economist with Farm Credit Canada. Let's listen in.
So what's causing this oil rout? Most people are worried about coronavirus, but then I also have heard that it's really about Russia and Saudi Arabia kicking off a price war. What can you tell us about that?
Well, correct. I mean, it's a combination of both, right? So both from a demand side of things, with the coronavirus having an impact or expected to have an impact on income, and given that the demand for fuel at the world level is connected to income. I mean, we tend to think here that we're not going to necessarily cut back too much on the fuel consumption when we're, you know, looking at any type of economic slowdown or even a recession. But at the world level, oil is really connected to overall global economic activity. So from a demand standpoint, there's the expectation that with the coronavirus, with consumer sentiment, and also how our businesses are looking at the current marketplace, I mean, that there's going to be lower demand for oil and fuel. And from a supply standpoint as well, for sure. I mean, OPEC has been, you know, in recent years, working with Russia, which is a really large supplier as well, to try to manage output, to bring some sort of stability to the oil market. But then it seems that negotiations broke down, and then that Saudi Arabia, which is the leader of the OPEC coalition of countries, has basically said that they're going to go at it alone and basically try to target, you know, their market share. And if they're, if you have a large producer just thinking about market share, then that leads to decisions that, you know, hey, I'm going to increase output, I'm going to try to steal away some of the sales from my competitors, and that all led to the significant price decline that we've seen in the marketplace.
And then that in turn seems to have infected some already nervous equity markets in terms of like the stock indexes and so on. Was this more or less expected?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's oil is a barometer of the health of the global economy. So it's not a perfect barometer. You know, we can talk about as well some of the linkages with ag commodities, but it's a barometer of how the economy is doing. And we know that when the economy is humming, and then when its projections are that it is going to grow at a fairly steady pace, then that the oil market, on the demand side at least, that there's less concern about what we're going to, or what businesses are likely to sell in the future. So, of course, you know, when you have those hiccups in the marketplace, significant hiccups, and we're talking about markets or movement in the marketplace, certainly for oil, that we haven't seen for decades. And so that has a big impact in overall markets. And you've seen financial markets now react as well. And it's also the fear of the coronavirus, not only affecting the supply side of the market. I always think along demand and supply. I mean, we know that supply chains have been affected by the coronavirus. What we don't know yet is to what extent consumer confidence, for example, is impacted or likely to be impacted in the next few months. I mean, we've seen central banks cut interest rates as an insurance against this breakdown of consumer confidence, right? Because if consumers are seen as spending less, then that brings down also business investment, and there's a little bit of a snowball effect. So the move by central banks, even though is not expected to resolve any of the supply chain issues that we have in the marketplace because of the virus, at least it is expected to support consumer confidence. But the thought now is, or the idea now is, that we're probably going to need a little bit more of support from central banks than what we've seen so far.
And then what about agricultural commodities? I have not yet seen the big moves. I think the last time I checked, corn was down about 1% on the day. What are we seeing there? Will it spill over into this? Do we know yet?
Well, I do expect ag commodity markets to be impacted a little bit more than what we've seen so far, if indeed we clearly see that, or we continue to see that the virus is not going to be contained. It is to be expected that as the virus takes center stage in a lot of countries, not just in China and Italy and a few others, but as well as, you know, makes its way to the United States, perhaps, and hopefully we hope that we're never going to have to deal with the extent of the virus that, you know, some of the European countries are dealing with right now. But in emerging markets, which have more of an impact on the overall demand of commodities, then perhaps your liabilities to income decline because of the virus lead to a little bit of demand destruction, as I'm talking about, right? So it's weaker demand for commodities. And to the extent that we haven't seen anything so far, maybe you could expect a little bit more of that as we learn a little bit more. But, I mean, you also have to be careful here. A lot of, sometimes, you know, we hear about some of the linkages between the oil market and commodity markets. And to some extent, it was really true when the ethanol market was booming, right? But now that we've more than matured in some ways, especially in the U.S. when it comes to ethanol and biofuels, we've seen a little bit that linkage sort of be, or the two markets be decoupled a little bit more than what we used to see in recent past. So to me, it's more about what is the likely effect on food demand and overall demand for commodities. And I do expect that to be weaker going forward. For how long and to what extent? Well, a lot of it depends on how exactly we see the virus grow and to what countries it has an impact on, especially a significant impact. So there's a lot of question and unknowns right now, but I do expect the demand side of the market to be impacted going forward.
So what is it going to take then to stabilize this situation? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I do think that it is definitely correlated with how we see the virus evolve in the near future. And as soon as we, you know, as soon as the market sees that, hey, this is, you know, the it's under control in the sense of, you know, that the number of new cases is starting to slow down as we're currently seeing in China right now. And if we can keep that up, if we can get better responses or coordinated responses, you know, across the world in terms of mitigating the impact and downplaying the effect and the cross-border transmission and so forth. When the markets are seeing a little bit more of that, there's some strong signals that this is actually occurring, I think that's going to bring a sense of stabilization to the entire economy and entire marketplace. And then it's going to be just a matter of assessing, quote-unquote, the damage, right? So we know supply chains have been damaged in the sense of, you know, plants being shut down, workers staying at home, and so forth. But I mean, in terms of bringing a little bit of stability, when we have a sense of, yeah, you know, this propagation of the virus is a little bit more under control, hasn't not necessarily stopped, but more under control, then we can start assessing the economic damage. And then this is perhaps when we get a sense of a rebound in the marketplace. But that could take some time, and that could be relatively quick, or it could take some significant time as well. I mean, this quite unknown right now as to what kind of economic damage we're going to likely see in the marketplace.
So what are some of the things you're going to be watching in the coming days, weeks, and months then to assess that?
Well, of course, we're going to be watching income, right? So when we're going to be watching income in the largest economies in the world, first and foremost, the U.S. and China, these two economies have had a major, major impact on ag and food markets. And if you think of not only, you know, the coronavirus, but also, for example, the phase one trade deal between China and the U.S., if you think of African swine fever in China that has created this huge gap between in protein, between supply and demand, all of these things are compounding on top of the coronavirus. So that's where I'm keeping an eye on first and foremost. It's really understanding what kind of demand are we likely to see coming out of China? What kind of slowdown this is going to have on an economy like the U.S. and for which our economy is absolutely closely connected to. And that's going to tell us a whole lot about, you know, the extent of a downturn, because we're likely, actually, there's pretty much certainty around the fact that we're going to see some sort of slowdown. And the question is to what extent and for how long. And so that, you know, looking at the U.S. and China first and foremost, I believe was going to give us a pretty good idea of how long this is going to last and what kind of an impact it could have in the marketplace.
And then a little closer to home then on the individual farm level, what would you tell farmers as business managers who are looking to make their way through this situation? What should they be paying attention to?
Well, of course, we've said in the past, you know, as far as I remember, actually, that, you know, we are in a marketplace or we're in an industry that we're used to ups and downs. But in this case, you know, the downs are likely, or the cycles are likely to be amplified in somehow just because of everything that is happening in the marketplace, whether it's the the trade tensions that we're involved with, you know, with China or India, or when it comes to, you know, China with the U.S., African swine fever, you know, and you have what's going on in the financial market. So it's really easy to get distracted. But I do believe that, you know, the sound basic principles of farm management, right, the basic stuff like know your cost of production, have a marketing plan, stick to it, understand what kind of stress your operation is likely to face in the future. So from a financial standpoint, you know, look at your production plans as well, understand what kind of risk you're exposed to from a production standpoint. Just those basic steps in terms of farm management, to me, really make a whole lot of sense, because there's so much that we don't know about in the future that the only thing that makes sense is really to plan for the what-if scenarios and understand where you stand with regards to a number of different variables that are important, right, from a financial standpoint, marketing standpoint, and production standpoint. And if you do get that, if you have that, those basics in place, I do believe that, you know, businesses are going to be able to get through this and be in a good spot.
Well, that's great, JP. Thank you so much for taking the time to fill us in on this.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
That was JP Gervais, the Vice President and Chief Agricultural Economist with Farm Credit Canada, in conversation with Manitoba Cooperator Editor Gord Gilmore. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard, and with what we've just heard, it's as good a time as any to bring in Bruce Burnett, the Director of Markets and Weather Information with Glacier Markets Farm. Welcome back.
Hi.
Now, so when I stopped looking at commodities last night, we had cattle and hog futures closing at or near limit down, and corn, soybeans, Kansas City, Minneapolis wheat also down, Chicago wheat up slightly for what I'm sure is an excellent reason. So it's Tuesday after lunch as we speak, and I'm afraid to ask what's happening.
Well, actually, the markets have recovered a bit, so
oh, good.
That's good news. The equity markets have moved higher, oil's moving higher, and the agricultural commodities generally are up. As we speak right now, canola's taking back most of the losses from yesterday.
Okay.
So really, we're seeing a bit of a recovery, although I think if you thought that the volatility is over from these events, I think you're sorely mistaken. We're going to see days like this here, I think, over the next few months, because the global economic situation seems to be worsening. And so there's a lot of investor money moving to the sidelines right now.
Mm-hmm. Now, is it fair to lay all the blame for this most recent decline on the crude oil price war, or is some of that still on the other C word?
Some of this is obviously on the crude oil, especially in the commodities complex, because oil is the largest traded commodity in the world. So mm-hmm. any of the other commodities like the agricultural commodities, there tends to be a knock-on impact, especially from commodity funds that will end up having to sell agricultural commodities just because their oil investments have gone down in value.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, generally speaking here, agricultural commodities are not impacted by the downturn in the economy or the COVID-19 virus infection rates. So I think basically it's still in this volatility panic selling mode that we're seeing the agricultural commodities. And when we, you know, sort of move back and take a look at the fundamentals here and realize that we're not going to see a big change in demand for them, then we'll start trading again at maybe more appropriate values.
So when will that be? When might that happen, though? I mean, when are we going to start seeing market fundamentals matter again?
Well, I think basically we'll have to go into a period of time when we finally see that the COVID virus infections around the globe start to tail off and start to peak out, and the market becomes more comfortable with the economic data, certainly in terms of registering how much the economy is declining. As we speak right now, the virus in China appears to be getting under control here, with the number of new cases declining still as we move along. And the economy in China is actually picking up a little bit. Of course, it's still about 20% below what it was before this infection hit. But certainly we're starting to see a bit of a recovery in Asia. We'd have to see that happen globally before I think everybody will be comfortable in trading some of the fundamentals.
Mm-hmm. Now, are there, speaking of fundamentals again, are there new numbers that might help with, are there any new numbers as far as commodities are concerned that might help sort of help drive a recovery that way? Or?
Well, we did have the USDA March report come out today, and essentially USDA indicated that for the major agricultural commodities, we saw very little in the way of changes. So really, again, that fits with this idea that we're not going to see any big changes in demand, certainly from this virus on the agricultural commodity side, because they didn't change demand numbers all that much for wheat, soybeans or corn, any of the other crops. So it's really a situation here where I think that, again, USDA realizes that they're not going to have a big influence because of the fact that people are looking at other things, but they're basically not changing their numbers very much at all. The one thing that they did do is they increased production in South America, like a million tons higher in Brazil, a million tons higher in Argentina. So we're seeing a little bit more on the soybean supply side globally, but again, that's not enough to really change the price prospects right now. Most of the traders, I think, have baked increased production in South America into their balance sheets already.
Mm-hmm. There was a bit of an uptick in this this export tax, as I recall, in Argentina on soybeans. Does that factor into?
Yes, the export tax that Argentina is going to likely add to the value of soybean, raw soybeans that are exported, will likely change the dynamics a bit in the soybean seed trade. What it does is it encourages domestic crushers in Argentina to crush more domestic grains and export the products like meal and oil, rather than let the soy or have the soybeans export by themselves, because the export taxes are different for those different commodities. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, though, a larger crop in South America still means that there's more in the way of soybean products on the world market, because Argentina is going to have access to supplies.
Mm-hmm. Now, with all this in mind that we've just talked about here, what's a farmer to do? I mean, is it what's the best course of action for a farmer here at home to take?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that play domestically here in Canada that we have to watch out for. First of all, we're still seeing delays on the West Coast in terms mm-hmm. of logistics and transportation. That's increasing basis levels in the countryside. So in other words, that's not creating a conducive environment for pricing right at the moment. That combined with this volatility, I think, means that most farmers probably should take a step back here in terms of marketing, just to see where things go over the next month or so. Certainly, we probably should see an improvement in the logistics over the next month. It appears as if the blockades are suspended, hopefully for the next while, so that the transportation system can catch up. If that does happen, then the basis levels should improve. And obviously, when we start trading fundamentals, especially for certain commodities, probably going to see a recovery from the price drop that we've seen from the January highs here. So again, most agricultural commodity markets are down between 5% and 10% since the January highs. We'll probably see those futures recover when we start trading the fundamentals, because as USDA told us today, things haven't changed all that much.
Mm-hmm. And we'll certainly be keeping an eye on that in the weeks and months to come. Bruce Burnett, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Bruce Burnett is the Director of Markets and Weather Information with Glacier Markets Farm. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard. That's all the time we have for this week, but feel free to tune back in next week with more from the Glacier Farm Media family of publications.
Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to btr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.